biggest, tallest, fastest, strongest, most, best. These are superlatives. You probably didn't think you're going to get a grammar lesson today, right? Superlatives are words that describe the extreme. They're words that catch our attention because humans are naturally drawn to extremes. We admire the tallest buildings, the fastest cars, the most talented athletes. We chase after the best of everything. One clear example of our chasing after the best is the world's tallest building. Architects, engineers, and cities, they all compete to reach higher and higher. The towers become a symbol of power, prestige, and brilliance. If you want proof of how deeply we love superlatives, there's an entire website devoted to it, www.skyscrapercenter.com. You can explore the tallest buildings in the world by height, by number of floors, by function, and even by which ones are still under construction. We don't just admire tall buildings. We rank them. We track them. We update the list every time someone builds something higher. Now, if you want to see the world's tallest building, you got to take a flight all the way to Dubai, which you can do with a direct flight from Singapore. And you can see the Burj Khalifa. I've actually been there in 2005, I think I was there. It is very tall. But closer to home, just a short flight to Kuala Lumpur, is the world's second tallest building, the Merdeka 118, not the Twin Towers, but it's a recent one. You can go a bit further and you can stand beneath the Shanghai Tower. Now, if you look at these images, you might think that the Malaysia Tower kind of cheats because of that little tower. In my mind, I think the Shanghai Tower is bigger probably than even though it's not as tall as the Burj Khalifa, it's massive. So I'd kind of like to see that one day. These structures are breathtaking. They represent human brilliance, creativity, and intelligence, engineering at the highest levels. Now, what's more striking, these buildings are impressive, but what's more striking is where these buildings are located. 7 of the world's top 10 largest buildings are here in the Asia-Pacific area. And then 40 of the top 50 are also in the Asia-Pacific. That's China, Japan, Korea, Malaysia, basically. Now, here's where the story gets interesting. If you look at buildings under construction, though, there's no more in Asia of the top 10 and only 15 of the top 50. You might wonder, what happened? Well, economic pressure played a part. Changing priorities. In China specifically, there was a deliberate move away from what they called vanity buildings. These are buildings that were designed to impress, but they weren't properly. They were very underutilized, high vacancy rates, and the government realized it was basically a waste of money. Some of the most sobering images come from China's ghost cities. These are cities where entire skylines are filled with these massive, beautiful towers, but very few people. Brilliant design, massive scale, but minimal life. And the word that's often used to describe these projects is vanity. And that's the word that opens the book we're going to look at today, which is Ecclesiastes. So please go and turn in your Bibles or your Bible apps to the book of Ecclesiastes. We're going to be looking at chapters 1 and 2 today in a sermon that I've titled Genius Level Depression. This is King Solomon, obviously the genius we're talking about here. His take on chasing superlatives. He's exposing what happens when brilliance is pushed to the extreme, when wisdom, success, and achievement are pursued without God. And that's what Ecclesiastes 1 and 2 are all about. A man with unmatched wisdom and genius-level insight in his search to discover the meaning of life. Now, today's message starts an entire series on the book of Ecclesiastes, which I've called Without God, Life Stinks. It's going to be a 6-part series, basically structured like the 12 chapters of Ecclesiastes. So it's going to be quite a lot of material each time, 2 chapters or so. And it's kind of divided into 2 parts. Chapters 1 through 6 will be 3 sermons, and I've called this section, section 1, The Futility of Living in a Frustrating World, which is basically Solomon's search for the meaning of life. And then in the second part, basically starting to end of chapter 6, 7 through 12, and basically, for the next 3 weeks, we're going to cover the first 6 chapters, and I'm going to be out of the country for about 3 more weeks, and in February and March, we'll finish up the series. And together, these 6 messages will help us see us one clear truth. When God is removed from the center, even the best the world has to offer falls flat. So today, we begin where Ecclesiastes begins, with a brilliant man, an honest question, is there meaning to life? But first, let's watch this short clip from the Bible Project that provides an overview of the entire book.
The book of Ecclesiastes. It's part of the Bible's wisdom literature, and it opens with this line, the words of Kohelet, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. Now, in Hebrew, the word Kohelet means someone who has gathered people together. And in this case, it's to learn, so it's often translated in English as teacher. And the teacher is said to be a son or a descendant of King David. And so there are different views about who this figure might have been. Many think that it refers to King Solomon, others to maybe one of the later kings of David's line, and still others think that it's actually a later Israelite teacher who has adopted a Solomon-like persona as a teaching aid. Whichever of these views is correct, the key thing is to recognize that the teacher is a character in the book and is different than the author of the book, who remains anonymous. So we do hear the teacher's voice for most of the book, but it's actually a different voice, the author, who introduces us to the teacher in the first sentence and then at the end concludes the book by summarizing and evaluating everything the teacher just said. So the author is someone who wants us to hear all that the teacher has to say and then help us process it and form our own conclusion. So what does the teacher have to say? Well, the author summarizes the teacher's basic message at the beginning and right at the end, and it's hevel, hevel. Everything is utterly hevel. Now, most English Bibles translate this word hevel as meaningless, but that doesn't quite capture the heart of the idea. In Hebrew, hevel literally means vapor or smoke, and the teacher uses this word 38 times in the book as a metaphor to describe how life is, first of all, temporary or fleeting, like a wisp of smoke. But secondly, also how life is an enigma or a paradox. Like smoke, it appears solid, but when you try and grab onto it, there's nothing there. So there's so much beauty or goodness in the world, but just when you're enjoying it, tragedy strikes and it all seems to blow away. Or we all have a strong sense of justice, but all the time bad things happen to good people. So life is constantly, it's unpredictable, it's unstable, or in the teacher's words, like chasing after the wind. Hevel. Now that's kind of a downer. So why is he saying all of this? The author's basic goal is to target all of the ways that we try to build meaning and purpose in our lives apart from God. And he lets the teacher deconstruct these. So the author thinks we spend most of our time investing energy and emotion in things that ultimately have no lasting meaning or significance. And he lets the teacher give us a hard lesson in reality. You can see this most clearly in the opening and closing poems, which focus first of all on time and then on death. So the teacher says, you can spend your whole life working and achieving because you think that makes your life meaningful. You should really stop and consider the march of time. For all of the human effort that takes place in the world, nothing really ever changes. So sure, we develop technology and we build nations that rise and fall, but go climb a mountain and see if it cares. It was there long before any of us, and it will be here long after. I mean, no one's even going to remember you or anything you did 100 years from now, but that mountain, it'll still be there. And the ocean will still be breaking on the beach, and the sun will still rise and set. And so time will eventually erase you and me and everything that we care about. And if that's not disheartening enough, the teacher also can't stop talking about death all the way through the book, but especially in this poem near the end. He says, death is the great equalizer, and it renders meaningless most of our daily activities. It devours the wise and the fool, the rich and the poor, no matter who you are, what you've done, good or bad, we're all going to die, and it's inescapable. So with these two ideas in hand, the teacher goes on to consider all the activities and false hopes that we invest our lives in to find meaning and significance, like wealth or career or social status or pleasure. So you think working hard is going to make life worth it? Think about the stress and the toll that that takes on you, all the anxiety and the sleepless nights. And by the time you actually earn some wealth, you're going to be too old to enjoy it anyway. And then by the time that you have to pass it on to someone, they may not even be someone who cares about anything that you did. Or maybe you think pleasure is going to make life worth it for you. Go for it. You know, live for your vacations, live for the weekend party. Monday always comes. Hevel, hevel. Everything is utterly hevel. So what does the teacher advocate, then? That we become pure hedonists or relativists? Well, no, that would be Hevel, too. The teacher acknowledges the ideas from Proverbs, that living by wisdom and the fear of the Lord, that these have real advantages. On the whole, life will probably go better for you. See, but the problem is that even living by wisdom and the fear of the Lord, they're Hevel, too, because they don't guarantee a good life. Good people die tragically, and horrible people live long and prosper. There's just too many exceptions, and so even wisdom is a Hevel. Again, not meaningless, but an enigma. Wisdom doesn't work the way you think it should all of the time. So what's the way forward in the midst of all this Hevel? And here, paradoxically, the teacher discovers the key to the true enjoyment of life under the sun. It's accepting Hevel. It's acknowledging that everything in your life is totally out of your control. About 6 different times at some of the bleakest moments in his monologue, the teacher talks about the gift of God, which is the enjoyment of simple, good things in life, like friendship or family, a good meal or a sunny day. You can't control these things. You're certainly not guaranteed them, but that's their beauty. When I come to adopt a posture of total trust in God, it frees me to simply enjoy my life as I actually experience it, not as I think it ought to be, because even my expectations about what life ought to be are ultimately Hevel. Hevel. Everything under the sun is utterly Hevel. And so the teacher's words come to a close. Right here at the end, the author speaks up again, and he brings it all to a conclusion. He says, the teacher's words are very important for us to hear. He likens them to a shepherd's staff with a goad, a pointy end, which might hurt when it pokes you, but he says the teacher is trying to poke you to get you to move in the right direction, towards greater wisdom. The author then warns us that you can actually take the teacher's words too far, and you could spend your whole life buried in books trying to answer life's existential puzzles. Don't try, he says. You'll never get there. And so instead, the author offers his own conclusion, and it's this. Fear God and keep his commandments. This is the whole duty of humans, for God will bring every deed into judgment, every hidden thing, whether good or evil. And so the author thinks it's good to let the teacher challenge your false hopes and remind you that time and death make most of life completely out of your control. But what gives life true meaning is the hope of God's judgment, the hope that one day God will clear away all of the Hevel and bring true justice to our world. And it's that hope that should fuel a life of honesty and integrity before God, despite the fact that I remain puzzled by most of life's mysteries. And that's the wisdom of the book of Ecclesiastes.
So in the Bible Project overview, you may have noticed the distinction they made between the author, that's the one who wrote the book, and then the teacher, the one whose words make up the majority of the book. Basically, the author has a short blurb at the beginning and a short blurb at the end. And this is a distinction that's widely accepted. Most scholars can see it. I mean, it's very clear when you read the book. It goes from first person to third person to first person. Now, what's not clear is when the author stops speaking and then Solomon, the teacher, starts. I think it is, but the Bible Project suggested it started at chapter 1, verse 3. I tend to think that it's chapter 1, verse 12, because I called chapters verses 1 through 11 the problem stated, the author summary, then the second section would be Solomon speaking. And I think that fits well because verse 12, Solomon the teacher begins speaking directly. It's basically a second prologue. So verses 1 through 11 is kind of like the author summarizing Solomon's words, and then chapter 12 is Solomon himself summarizing what he's going to explore. And this sermon today is going to, and then basically the exploration is the bulk of chapter 2, verses 1 through 23. We'll spend quite a bit of time on that today, and we'll finish with the end of chapter 2, verses 24 to 26, a brief but important summary, because the first part's quite dark, and so we're going to end with a crack in the darkness, a little bit of light starting to shine through. You may have noticed, if you've looked at Ecclesiastes, it's very repetitive. Some of the stuff we looked at today on the video showed us chapter 9, so you're going to see it again. But I think Solomon does that because he wants us to, it's intentionally repetitive, sometimes cyclical, very unsettling. And Solomon does that because he wants us to feel the full weight of life under the sun. Okay, so Ecclesiastes 1:1 reads, "The words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem." So that description clearly points us to Solomon. Now, David had many sons, but only one was actually the king. One, others tried to be king, but Solomon was the king. And he was known throughout Scripture for unparalleled wisdom. Now, some critical scholars will suggest that the author is only writing in Solomon's voice, but the point is, the book intentionally grounds its message in Solomon's wisdom. In fact, I personally think Solomon wrote it from a two-voice perspective because it's so unified. The author's comments are completely unified with the teacher's comments, and so I think Solomon did that to basically give it more weight and give it more meaning. And again, that's the form we have today. That's the only form we've ever seen of this book. There's no separate writings of Solomon that we have that we could point to as saying someone put this together. So even though some modern scholars, a lot of the critics, the ones who try to take God out of the Bible, they try to point that, you know, and they can't ever come to a good justification for it. So we're going to look at it like it is, what it claims to be, Solomon's teachings on the meaning of life. Okay, verse 2. "Vanity of vanities," says the preacher. "Vanity of vanities. All is vanity." It's a lot of vanity in one verse, and it's very intentional. This verse functions as a thesis for the entire book. It's basically the author's one-sentence summary of Solomon's conclusions. And everything that follows, every experiment, every observation, every reflection, either supports the statement or explains how to live in light of it. But before we can understand what Solomon means by this, we need to understand this word he keeps repeating, hevel. So the Hebrew word translated as vanity in the ESV is hevel. So they pronounce it as a V. Literally, it means vapor, breath, mist, something you can see but can't hold. Figuratively, it could mean futile or empty, not worthless, but unable to last. A bubble looks beautiful for a moment. It floats. It shines. You can pass it. It captures your attention, and then it's gone. That's hevel. Solomon isn't saying that life has no value. He's saying that life, when pursued without God, is fragile, is fleeting, and unable to carry lasting meaning. That word hevel is a lens for everything that follows in Ecclesiastes. So Carla's passing out some bubbles right now. So anytime I come to the word vanity or the word meaningless, chasing the wind, I'd like us all to pause and blow bubbles to kind of remember this whole point of life, the enigma, the unable to comprehend. Okay, so vanity of vanities. I want to talk about that for a little bit. So up on the screen, you might see some pieces of furniture. But in Hebrew, it's two words put together. It's actually the same noun is repeated. One is in the singular form and the other one is a plural form. Vanity of vanities. This is a specific Hebrew construction. And reason why they had to do this in the Hebrew language, they didn't have the tallest, highest. They had tall of tall, high of high. You think of Holy of Holies, the holiest place, but they don't have that word, so it's called Holy of Holies. King of Kings, Lord of Lords. So and even New Testament, Paul said he was a Pharisee of Pharisees, so that idea continues. So the teacher is describing the ultimate vanity, vanity-est, I guess you could say. The most fleeting, vaporous breath image. If y'all see me blow bubbles, you can blow bubbles too. Okay. Now here's something interesting. The piece of furniture that we call a vanity. So if you see the vanities, you have a very simple vanity, just a desk and a mirror. Behind it, next to it, you have I like the one that they got up there. I could use that for tools. You got a vanity with lights and drawers and cubbies. It's the vanity of vanities. Now, this piece of furniture that's called a vanity actually actually gets its name from the biblical idea of focusing on self-adoration. But that word has kind of taken on a new meaning today. So today it's got a very limited meaning. You lose out on the true Hebrew, hevel, meaningless, enigma, futile. So what I'm going to do, I'm going to switch to the NLT version. And the NLT uses meaningless. Everything is meaningless. Completely meaningless. So as we continue on, we're going to be in the NLT instead. So you will no longer see vanity, you'll see meaningless. So after stating Solomon's shocking thesis that everything is meaningless, the author immediately begins us to show us why Solomon reached that conclusion. So verses 3 through 7 are his evidence. Verse 3 asks the driving questions. What do people get for all their hard work under the sun? In other words, what's the net gain? That phrase under the sun is crucial. It appears 28 times in the text. There's also similar phrases like under heaven and on earth. It describes life that's viewed horizontally only, as if this world is all there is. And starting in verse 4, the author points to nature. Generations come and go, but the earth never changes. The sun rises and the sun sets, and then hurries to rise again. The wind blows south and then turns north. Around and round it goes, blowing in circles. Rivers run into the sea, but the sea is never full. Then the water returns again to the rivers and flows out to the sea. Nature is locked in endless cycles, while human life is brief, like vapor. Okay, so before reading verses 8 through 11, we need to remember that these are Solomon's conclusions summarized by the author. So by comparing this endless cycle of nature with the brevity of human life, he reaches a sobering conclusion. Everything is wearisome beyond description. Now the author broadens his lens from nature to history. Reading verse 9, history merely repeats itself. It has all been done before. Nothing under the sun is truly new. Verse 10 reminds us how easily we fool ourselves. Sometimes people say, here is something new, but actually it is old. Nothing is ever truly new. You probably heard, there's nothing new under the sun. Verse 11 lands a blow. We don't remember what happened in the past, and future generations, no one will remember what we're doing now. Well, you might think, well, we're in the digital age. What I'm doing now is recorded on video and it'll be saved forever, right? Where do you save it? Do you have it on your computer, on an SSD? SSDs are all the rage now. They're fast, they're in all the computers, they're small, but they're less reliable than the old hard drives that spin. And the old hard drives that spin, they crashed. So all that stuff that's in the digital age is going to be gone. It's going to be forgotten. If you want something to last, you have to chisel it in stone. That phrase, there is nothing under the sun, is one of the most quoted Bible verses in secular cultures. It's usually quoted by old people to curb the young people's enthusiasm, sometimes out of cynicism, but it really shows the honest result of looking for meaning under the sun. Now, Solomon says there is nothing new under the sun, and one of the least new things in human history is to try to find the meaning of life. In the modern era, especially with the Enlightenment period, philosophers and writers, they tried to build a meaningful life without God, a meaningful life under the sun, only with reason, nature, progress, and experience, but without a personal covenantal God. You may have heard of Friedrich Nietzsche. He's famous for saying this, God is dead. He looked at a culture that pushed God aside, and his conclusion was that it would be nihilism. No ultimate meaning, no solid moral anchor, just humans in trying to invent purpose for themselves. His conclusion was, you can't. So what happened to Nietzsche? Anybody know? He ended up going insane. He's so focused on this question, he realized how meaningless life was, he kind of went crazy. Ernest Hemingway tried a different route, famous author. He lived life intensely through success, pleasure, courage, and experience, but his writings all circle around the same emptiness that Solomon is describing here. Both would agree with the statement, everything is meaningless, completely meaningless. Unfortunately, both of their lives, including Hemingway's life, their lives ended tragically under the sun, and that's exactly the tension that Ecclesiastes is expressing us to feel. Now, before Solomon speaks for himself, the author gave us a summary of Solomon's life's work. The teacher, in verses 1 through 11, we're handed the conclusion up front. The teacher is identified, Solomon, a man with unparalleled wisdom. The thesis is stated, everything is meaningless. The evidence is shown. Life under the sun runs in endless, worrisome cycles. And the conclusion is sobering. Nothing truly satisfies, nothing is truly new, and nothing is ultimately remembered. Again, this isn't Solomon thinking out loud. This is the author summarizing where Solomon's search will end up. Let's see where he goes. Your next section is called Brilliant Minds, Bleak Results. So starting in verse 12, the voice shifts from the third person, the teacher, to the first person, I, the teacher. This is why I think this is Solomon starting to speak. These are Solomon's own words, and this section gives us Solomon's personal testimony. Okay, so this is kind of in a cyclical section. Solomon's going to say a series of stuff, and he's going to say it again slightly different. So I'm going to put the two verses side by side that kind of show what he's saying. This is basically his prologue, his introduction to the rest of the book. So he starts off kind of like the author started off by identifying whose words these are. I, the teacher, was king of Israel, and I lived in Jerusalem. Yep, that could be Solomon. I said to myself, look, I am wiser than any of the kings who ruled before me in Jerusalem. I have greater wisdom and knowledge than any of them. And again, of course, that's speaking of Solomon. That's verses 12 and 16. Now, some critics will point out that the verb used is the perfect tense. Solomon said, I was king. But if Solomon was writing this, he should have said, I am king. But if you're an author and you're writing a deep work that is going to outlast you, when you're dead, you're no longer king. So Solomon, of course, wouldn't say, I am king. He's writing this for posterity's sake. He would say, I was king, because he knows when people are reading it, this is after he's passed. And this is also one of the books written towards the end of his life. Solomon is credited with the Song of Songs, Proverbs, and then this book. And so a Song of Songs is a very strong, almost erotic, is what some people say, book about love. He wrote that when he was young. He wrote Proverbs in his midlife, compiling all his wisdom, and he wrote this Ecclesiastes towards the end. Next, Solomon tells us what he sets out to do, and again, he does it twice. Verse 13, I devoted myself to search for understanding and to explore by wisdom everything being done under the sun, under heaven. And 17, so I set out to learn everything from wisdom to madness and folly. And again, the scope of his search is clear. Everything. Nothing is off limits, from wisdom to madness to folly. And if meaning can be found under the sun, Solomon will find it. Now comes Solomon's bitter discoveries. There it goes. The author's already summarized them as meaningless. Now Solomon says it himself. I soon discovered that God has dealt a tragic existence to the human race. I observed everything going on under the sun, and really, it is all meaningless, like chasing the wind. Uh-oh. But I learned firsthand that pursuing all this is like chasing the wind. Now, you can pursue wisdom, success, fame, pleasure, bubbles, maybe even grasp them for a moment, but they always slip away. Yeah, you're not going to grasp a bubble. And notice this, because Ecclesiastes is looking at life under the sun, Solomon's not going to look at the covenantal promises of God towards Israel. He is going to look at, though, Genesis chapter 3. This sounds very familiar. By the sweat of your face you shall eat bread till you return to the ground, for out of it you are taken, you are dust, and to dust you shall return. So because of the curse, because of Adam's sin, people turn their back on God, and the result is life under the sun on this earth. But again, we know God created an ultimate plan for recovery from this situation, and that's what the whole Bible story is about. Finally, Solomon gives us his painful conclusion. What is wrong cannot be made right. What is missing cannot be recovered. Literally, the Hebrew says, what is crooked cannot be made straight. Moral direction, both the Old and New Testament, is often directional. Jesus said of the Pharisees, they did not know their right hand from their left hand, meaning they didn't know right from wrong. So this is a theme seen all throughout Scripture. Verse 18 then delivers a personal cost. The greater my wisdom, the greater my grief. To increase knowledge only increases sorrow. Again, this is a very often quoted and a little bit different. You ever heard the phrase, ignorance is bliss? This is where it comes from. Solomon learned more than anyone, and it hurt more than he expected. So that's here's a summary of section 2, verses 12 through 18. It's a carefully cyclical structured summary. The king is reintroduced twice. The task is defined twice. The discoveries are bitter twice. And the conclusion is painful, not once, but twice. Brilliant mind, bleak results. And with that groundwork laid, Solomon is now ready to take us even further into pleasure, into work, into success and achievement. This is probably the longest section of the sermon today, and it's probably also the darkest section that we will look at. As we move into chapter 2, Solomon's going to shift from observing life to experimenting with life. Have you ever wanted something that you thought would finally satisfy? Again, that's the whole point of advertising, right? You must have the latest phone, big screen TV, condo, car, whatever it is. But maybe once you have it, maybe even lining up for lunch at Chick-fil-A to have the world's best chicken sandwich that just opened up at Dobie Gout last week. But if you eat Chick-fil-A day after day, day after day, after a month, you'll say, this is still the world's best sandwich. But maybe after a year, you might start to think, hey, it's just a sandwich. That's the way life is. Eventually, everything is just meh. I don't know, is there a Singlish word for that? Everything is just like, ah, I don't know. I didn't get a chance to look that up. Mundane, yeah. So we live in a world that promises fulfillment through more pleasure, more knowledge, or harder work, but it often leaves us empty. In Ecclesiastes, this first part of chapter 2, Solomon, the wisest and wealthiest king who ever lived, runs his own experiment on life with unlimited resources. He pursues everything that the world offers. But his conclusion is blunt and unforgettable. I tried everything. It didn't work. So his first thing that he tries is pleasure through leisure. Not reckless pleasure, but intentional pleasure. He wants to know whether enjoyment itself can give life meaning. Pleasure through leisure. So listen to how he frames this experience. In verse 2, chapter 2, verse 1, I said to myself, come on, let us try pleasure. Let's look for the good things in life. But I found that this too was meaningless. Jumping ahead to verse 3a, I decided to cheer myself with wine while still seeking wisdom. So notice Solomon, he isn't losing control. He's still seeking wisdom, even through foolishness, even through wine, which is kind of a misnomer because when you pursue wine, then you tend to lose wisdom. He's asking, can pleasure, when pursued thoughtfully, carry the full weight of life? And today's world is even easier to pursue leisure. Think about this. In Solomon's day, you would see a play maybe once, for the kings and queens, maybe once every couple months or something like that. It wasn't until radio, TV, the multimedia age that we have leisure on our phones. We have constant hours and hours of entertainment that was not available to Solomon. And sometimes because of that, it might take us a little longer to reach a conclusion that it's all meaningless. But eventually a lot of people do realize I need to be careful about saying meaningless too much, otherwise we're blowing bubbles all day and we never get through the sermon. Only got 40 more pages to go. Just kidding. We're at slide 30 of 50, so we're making pretty good pace. But you got to realize that this world, the easy accessibility of leisure today is very troublesome, and it's really impacting that generation that's raised in the digital age, us older people, because we have issues with tech. Sometimes it's just, Netflix is not working, we give up. But the young'uns will figure out how to make it work, VPNs or whatever. And so, but that's so distracting. And sometimes that's the point, because people realize how meaningless life is. They bury themselves in that type of leisure. But again, Solomon points out that it's not enough. The next, Solomon turns to a deeper kind of pleasure, the satisfaction of building, creating, and producing pleasure through achievement. We read starting in verse 4, I also tried to find meaning by building huge homes for myself and by planting beautiful vineyards. I made gardens and parks, filling them with all kinds of fruit trees. I built reservoirs to collect the water to irrigate my flourishing groves. Now, what's missing in the English translations, but seen in the Hebrew, is a preposition, for myself. It's repeated 8 times in the Hebrew. If you look at this, you might think, maybe he's doing this out of philanthropic, he wants to be a good leader and do good things. No, he's doing this all for himself. And so don't think he's doing it because of, I want to have, you know, good motives. He's doing it for himself. That's what the Hebrew really shows at. The English point leaves that out because it'd be overly repetitive, but it's still quite clear that he's doing this for himself. And the other thing is, look what he's trying to build. He's trying to recreate paradise. He's trying to create a garden, because from the garden where God created for man to dwell with him permanently, we got kicked out because of sin. Eventually, one day we will be restored. Well, we can't get there on our own. And Solomon realizes that. Now, Solomon pushes the experiment even further. He seeks pleasure through abundance. No limits, no restraint, nothing withheld. 2:7, he says, I bought slaves, men, women, and others were born into my household. I also owned large herds and flocks. I collected great sums of silver and gold. Speaking of large households, I heard in a podcast recently that in the U.S. they have in vitro fertilization and basically will let anybody do it without proper supervision. And they realize that certain people who were sponsoring, paying for fathering were men from China who wanted to create like 100 kids so that his legacy would be continued through his family, all fathered by him through surrogates. Check out the Albert Mueller podcast within the last 2 weeks. He kind of talks about that. And this is something that China won't allow. They realize how foolish that is. But U.S. Is kind of veered off the track and does a lot of things that are considered foolish because of the worldview about people can mutilate their own bodies and everything. But back to what we're talking about, abundant. So yeah, abundant. So somebody's going to have a very abundant household because they're billionaires and they can afford 100 kids that are fathered through them through IVF. But Solomon says all of that doesn't work. Abundance could never satisfy the human heart. And again, if it could, he would be the man who, because he had enough abundance, he was very wealthy. Moving on, so now Solomon steps back and he's going to evaluate this whole experiment. And here is his verdict on pleasure. So I became greater than all those who lived in Jerusalem before me, and my wisdom never failed me. Wisdom never failed me. Interesting. So if you know the story of Solomon, he was the wise, you know, God asked him, ask me anything, I'll give it to you, and he asked for wisdom. So God gave it to him in abundance. But if you look at how Solomon's life ended, he ended up taking many harems, many women, concubines as wives, over 700 or 900 wives. He ended up going to Egypt to get horses. And if you look at the end of Deuteronomy, the law says, do not go to Egypt to get horses. It seemed like Solomon looked at that and says, I will do that, I will do that. Everything it said do not do, he did. It's almost like he had wisdom and didn't use it. He had wisdom and wasn't smart. The Bible is very clear. He had wisdom. J. Vernon McGee kind of says that he had wisdom in ruling and leading, maybe kind of a limited level of wisdom, but not how to live a godly life, which basically did allow him to do this experiment and leave this word for us. So that's my thoughts on wisdom never failing. It never did fail him. He just failed to use it. So anything I wanted, I would take. I denied myself no pleasure, but as I looked at everything I had worked so hard to accomplish, it was all so meaningless, like chasing the wind. There was nothing worthwhile anywhere. He had everything. He enjoyed it all and still slipped through his fingers. Pleasure can be enjoyed, but it cannot sustain meaning, at least under the sun. So let's recap Solomon's search, verses 1 through 11. First, he tests pleasure through leisure. That is fun, enjoyment, the good life. Nice for a while, but cannot last. Then he goes for pleasure through achievement, building projects, creating beauty, making life impressive. Looks like success, but still empty. And next, he removes every limit, money, comfort, experience. And if abundance could satisfy, Solomon had more than enough. Then he steps back and he gives a verdict. He enjoyed it all, held nothing back, and says it was meaningless, like chasing the wind. If we had young kids here, they would be chasing the bubbles. In Singapore terms, everything also bo liao. Is that right? Bo liao? Bo liao? Bo liao. Yeah, that's it. That's what Google says anyway. So Solomon pleasure promised a lot, but it didn't deliver. And Solomon's not done searching yet. So after exploring pleasure, Solomon now turns to wisdom. Now, if meaning could be found anywhere, you'd think that wisdom would be the place. Solomon was known for wisdom. He taught wisdom. He lived wisdom for the most part. So now he asks the obvious question. If pleasure doesn't work, maybe wisdom will. Well, wisdom certainly knows more, right? But Solomon's about to show us that under the sun it still gains nothing. So let's read. So I decided to compare wisdom with foolishness and madness. For who can do this better than I, the king? I thought, wisdom is better than foolishness, just as light is better than darkness. For the wise can see where they are going, but fools walk in the dark. So Solomon is being honest. Wisdom is better than foolishness. He compares them using a simple image, light and darkness. A wise person can see where they're going. They avoid obvious traps. They make better decisions. Now, his insight is just as true today. Think about real life. In money, wisdom would mean living within your means, not spending tomorrow's paycheck today. But foolishness says, just put it on a card. I'll deal with it later. Pay now. Pay la, right? In relationships, wisdom means listening, apologizing, setting boundaries. Foolishness reacts, lashes out, burns bridges. So if you think about that, what do you see on social media? Mostly foolishness. You don't see the listening, apologizing, setting boundaries. You see attacks. You see people making fun of other people. In work, wisdom shows up as integrity, patience, doing the right thing. Foolishness cuts corners and looks for shortcuts, tries to get rich quick, gambling, betting. Yet I saw that the wise and the fools share the same fate. Both will die. So I said to myself, since I will end up the same as a fool, what's the value of all my wisdom? This is all so meaningless. That worked. For the wise and the foolish both die. The wise will not be remembered any longer than the fool in the days to come. Both will be forgotten. Actually, some fools are remembered longer than the wise people, right? There's something called the Darwin Awards where people end up getting hurt doing foolish things. They get their 15 minutes of fame on Facebook. Again, foolishness. So no matter how carefully the wise live, no matter how recklessly the fool stumbles, both arrive at the same end. And that realization crushes Solomon. He asks, what's the value of all my wisdom? And if the outcome is the same, what did all that effort really gain? Worse still, both the wise and the foolish are eventually forgotten. So I came to hate everything because everything done here under the sun is so troubling. Everything is meaningless, like chasing the wind. So this section ends with the most one of Solomon's most honest lines. So I came to hate life. Not because wisdom is bad, but because wisdom alone couldn't answer life's deepest questions. Even the greatest wisdom couldn't overcome the reality of death or the emptiness of being forgotten. The wisest man alive couldn't find meaning in wisdom alone. We won't either. Now, before we move on, I want to point out something that seems to deeply trouble Solomon. The fear of being forgotten. Think about this. If someone gets their 15 minutes of fame, after they're gone, time moves on and memory fades. In fact, some people are forgotten. Even famous people are sort of forgotten while they're still alive. Not long ago, Gene Hackman, a well-known Hollywood actor, passed away quietly, largely unnoticed, until 9 or 10 days after his death was he finally discovered. Again, a sad story how that happened. But in the end, before he died, he was alone and not remembered. And that's what Solomon wrestles with. But here's what we need to remember. We are not limited to life under the sun. We are never forgotten by God. I had verses here. Isaiah 49:16 tells us, I have engraved you on the palms of my hand. Luke 12:7, even the hairs of your head are all numbered. So even though Solomon has shown us the despair of wisdom under the sun, we all know where our hope is truly found. So after chasing pleasure and finding it empty, Solomon turned to wisdom. And honestly, wisdom is better than foolishness, like light is better than darkness. So why see where they're going? They avoid traps, make better choices, money, relationships, and work. But then comes the crushing blow. The wise and the fool share the same fate. Both die, both are forgotten. So Solomon asks, what's the point of all my wisdom? And in despair, he says, I so hated life because everything is meaningless. You can blow if you want. You can blow your bubbles if you want. Even the wisest man couldn't escape death or fear of being forgotten under the sun. Okay, Solomon has tried pleasure. It was empty. He tried wisdom. It knew more, but still gained nothing because it couldn't be death. And now he looks at the fruit of all of his hard work, the empire he built, the wealth he earned. Now, this section is also kind of a repetitive cycle, so I'm going to read the verses together. It's a little more split up, though. First, Solomon doesn't deny what work builds, the gains of work. Verse 18, I came to hate all my hard work here on earth, again acknowledging that he has worked hard and built stuff. Some people work wisely with knowledge and skill. So because of your work, things will get built. That's the first section, the work's implied gains. But here's the problem. He has to leave it behind. And twice he says, first, for I have to leave others everything I've earned. And who can tell whether my successors will be wise or foolish? Yet they will control everything I have gained by my skill and my hard work under the sun. And later he says basically the same thing. Then must leave the fruit of their efforts to someone who hasn't worked for it. Everything you build, everything you own, one day it goes to someone else. And you have zero control over whether they will be wise stewards. You can have a will and control who it goes to, but you can't control what they do with it. Now today that work often shows up as net worth. And what we leave behind is called an inheritance. And that's why when my kids ask me about their inheritance, I tell them, I'm spending it all. Thank you, Solomon. They don't like that. So, and the pain doesn't stop when you clock off. Verse 20, so I gave up in despair, questioning the value of all my hard work in this world. And 23, their days of labor are filled with pain and grief. Even at night, their minds cannot rest. Anxiety, insomnia, people are up replaying the day's events. It's all meaningless. Despair, days full of pain and grief, mind racing. Solomon says, I hated all my work, not because work is bad, but because apart from God, it ends in emptiness and endless anxiety. So here's the summary. How meaningless. Work builds much, but leaves nothing. Work can give you a lot, but can't give you lasting meaning or security. Only God can give your labor eternal purpose, and only He can give you rest, true rest for your soul. So let's trust Him with what we build and with what we leave behind. So as Solomon's search comes to an end, we see that leisure fails because it cannot satisfy desire. We see that wisdom fails because it cannot defeat death, and work fails because it cannot secure legacy. Up to this point, Solomon's search has only led to frustration. Pleasure failed, wisdom failed, work failed. But then, almost quietly, something changes. Verses 24 through 26, Solomon introduces a new idea. It's not a full answer yet, but it's a crack in the darkness. It's a light like a candle far away. And for the first time, enjoyment is no longer something we chase. It's something we receive, a gift from God. But there's still a transition. There's not a resolution. The tension is still there. We're reading verse 24. So I decided there is nothing better than to enjoy food and drink. So as we mentioned during our announcements, our church is going to enjoy food and drink after our worship service for our third Sunday fellowship. So please enjoy food or drink with us, because that's what Solomon says to do. Enjoy food or drink and find satisfaction in work. Then I realized those pleasures are from the hand of God. For who can eat or enjoy anything apart from Him? The joys that Solomon specifies here are eating, drinking, and work. Wait, what? Earlier, Solomon said, already told us that we cannot sustain ultimate meaning in leisure, such as eating and drinking. So what changed? The key is the phrase, from the hand of God. When we chase things to give us ultimate meaning, we can never catch them. But when we receive them as gifts, we receive them humbly, then suddenly they become sources of real joy. So the difference is we can't chase after it, but we can receive it. And here's why we can receive them that way. Because we were made in God's image. We were made to live in a perfect creation, the garden. We were taken out of it, but we're still made in God's image, and we still have a path back to that garden. From the moment we're conceived to the day we take our last breath, we have inherent worth. Not because of what we produce, not because we're useful or convenient or what we chase, but because God stamped his image on us. Now, the world often forgets this. It says that a baby in the womb only has worth if the mother wants it. It says that an elderly or a suffering person only has worth if they're still productive. But God says, no. Every breath, every life bears my image. Every simple meal, every day of work, every breath is a gift from me. So don't gasp. Don't grasp after it, but receive. Eat your nasi lemak. Enjoy your kopi. Find satisfaction in your job. Not as idols, but as gifts from God who loves you and says you are fearfully and wonderfully made. That's where real joy is found. Solomon continues, verse 26, God gives wisdom, knowledge, and joy to those who please him. But if a sinner becomes wealthy, God takes that wealth away and gives it to those who please him. At first glance, that sounds familiar and reassuring. God rewards the righteous. God frustrates the wicked. That fits much of the Psalms when the writers cry out to God to judge the world in righteousness. It fits Proverbs, which observes that wise living often leads to blessing, and foolish living leads to loss. So we might expect Solomon to end on a positive note, but he doesn't. He ends this section by saying, this too is meaningless, like chasing the wind. Not because God is absent, not because God is unjust, but because under the sun, even God's good purposes often feel incomplete. Remarkably, the New Testament actually agrees. Romans chapter 8, verses 18 to 32, this is from what we read earlier. When Paul acknowledges that the sufferings of this present time, he is describing the very same reality that Solomon is wrestling with. Paul says in verse 20, for the creation was subjected to futility. The word futility is Paul's way of describing what Solomon keeps calling hevel. Frustration, decay, exhaustion, things not working the way they should. In other words, Solomon wasn't being pessimistic, he was being accurate. The weariness we feel, the sense that work, wisdom, pleasure fall short, the frustration that nothing quite lasts, that's creation itself, groaning under the weight of the fall. But here's where Paul goes further than Solomon. Solomon only saw the futility under the sun. Futility. But Paul says creation was subjected to futility in hope. Key word there. Creation groans not because it is meaningless, but because it is waiting. Waiting for redemption. Waiting for restoration. Waiting for what God has promised, but not fully revealed. So Ecclesiastes gives us a diagnosis, but Romans gives us the explanation and the hope. Now, God didn't answer creation's groaning with a philosophy. He didn't respond with a system. He didn't send better instructions. But when the fullness of time had come, he came himself. Galatians 4:4 tells us that Jesus was born not randomly, not urgently, but exactly the right time. After centuries of waiting, after generations of groaning, the world had fully felt its futility, God entered the story. Christmas is God's declaration that the waiting of Romans 8 was not in vain. The fullness of time didn't mean that the world was finally ready. It means God's plan was ready. And into a world marked by a hevel, God sent his son. So we are no longer waiting for God to act. We are living in what God has already begun. But this Christmas, because Christ has come, and because God has already acted, this changes how we live in the meantime. So this Christmas, this taking the theme from the last two sermons from Pastor Remulal this Christmas, stop asking creation to save you. Christ has come. Stop demanding ultimate joy from pleasure, wisdom, or work. They were never merry. They were never meant to carry the weight. This Christmas, receive life as God's gift. Jesus didn't come because we earned meaning. He came because God gives it. So receive your work, your rest, your joy, not as proof of work, of worth, but as gifts from the hand of God. And this Christmas, live with hope while you wait. The world still groans, but now it groans in expectation because the one creation was waiting for has already come, and he will come again. So this Christmas, in a world that still groans and waits, we lift our eyes from what cannot satisfy, and we behold our God, the one who entered our futility, the one who gives meaning, the one who will make all things new. Let us pray. Gracious Heavenly Father, we confess that we have often looked to pleasure, wisdom, and work to give us only what you can give. Thank you for seeing our groaning and answering it not with words, but with your Son. In the fullness of time, you sent Jesus into a broken world marked by futility so that our waiting would not be empty and our hope would not be in vain. Father God, teach us this Christmas to receive life as your gift, to rest in what Christ has already done, and to live with hope as we wait for what you have promised. As we sing now, turn our eyes from ourselves and help us behold you, our Creator, our Redeemer, our God. We pray this in the name of your Son, Jesus. Amen.